Today on Wings, from our sister series in Australia, prison abolition is a great ideal, but meanwhile there are practical alternatives for stopping the things that land most people in prison.
Overwhelmingly, if you look at the number of women in prison, they are going there for drug-related offences. The overwhelming majority are survivors of sexual and other violences in their life. So basically, we send people to prison who have been hideously violated in the community.
Creative Interventions was started to give credibility to the kind of everyday actions that people do take to interrupt, prevent, and repair from violence in their own lives.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Long to spend time with my sisters.
Welcome to Women on the Line, Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs program, produced at 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne and broadcast on the Community Radio Network. I'm Marion Prickett, and I'll be with you on the program this week. Currently, there are almost 30,000 people serving time in an Australian jail, some of which are run by private companies for profit. In today's show, we're going to take a look at prisons in Australia and ask, what would a world without prisons look like?
I suppose it's got to do with my dreaming.
I'll be speaking to longtime prison activist and lawyer Amanda George about the state of prisons in Australia 20 years after the first private prison opened. We'll also hear from Rachel Herzing, who recently visited Australia with the US-based organisation Creative Interventions, a group that seeks to end violence without intervention from the state. Borowon Correctional Centre in Queensland became Australia's first private prison when it opened in 1990. In the 20 years since then, private prisons have sprung up across the country. But many prison activists argue that it is simply morally indefensible for companies to make a profit out of incarceration. Indeed, many go further, saying that all prisons, whether they're run by the state or not, do nothing to make our communities safer. They argue that prisons cannot be reformed and should instead be abolished. Amanda George tells us more. It's been 20 years since the first private prison was opened, a move that many people argued against. What's wrong with private prisons?
Ideologically, what's wrong with prisons from our perspective is that it's an absolute obscenity for any organisation to make a profit out of the human suffering that prisons are there to inflict. On a practical level, what private prisons have meant have been basically cheap skate services run away from the gaze of people who are interested in making the prison system as a whole accountable. In Victoria particularly, there was a very, very strong war waged against private prisons when they were first introduced here under the Kennett government. However, as you correctly said, the first private prisons were actually in Queensland. Interesting thing is that a lot of people think, private prisons really are a huge thing in the United States from whence they came. However, there are relatively very few private prisons in the US. There's 100. And actually there are thousands and thousands of prisons in the States. In Australia, we have got 8 private prisons, and essentially the big company that has the contract is the same company that has the contract for the detention centres. What we know about any private organisation is that its first priority must be seeking profit. And so if that's your first priority, other things must come after it. And what we saw in Victoria is private companies that have a vested interest in not being completely upfront about what's going on in them. Because if they, because their performance depends on the number of assaults, the number of self-harms, the number of escapes, well, it's obvious then that there will be definitional dances going on around, for example, what is an assault. So an assault might be me pushing somebody, or an assault might be me banging someone over the head. Now, depending on what the prison operator defines as a reportable incident, something that's an assault in one prison might not deem to be an assault in another prison. Therefore, if it's in a private prison, you will perhaps have a greater vested interest in downplaying incidents because your profit depends on them not being there to make you lose performance in your contract.
There's been a growing prison abolition movement in the United States for some time now. What does prison abolition mean?
What it means is firstly looking at who is sent to prison. Who are the people who go there and what do they go there for? Overwhelmingly, if you look at the number of women in prison, they are going there for drug-related offences, generally what we call property offences, thefts, frauds, burglaries, that sort of thing. However, that, those offences are being committed to purchase drugs. Why is it that so many women are drug and alcohol dependent who are in prison? Well, as I said to you, the overwhelming majority of women are survivors of sexual and other violences in their life. So if you just sort of scratch the surface of who we send to prison, basically we send people to prison who have been hideously violated in the community. So what needs to happen is we need to have services in the community so that people, number one, aren't as hideously violated by sexual abuse within the family, and number two, if they are, that we actually have services in the community to assist women to not have to blot themselves out from the pain of sexual abuse by using all the time. So what it means is having, number one, housing in the community that's secure and that's safe for women who are taking themselves and their children out of family violence situations. You need to have drug and alcohol services in the community that are appropriate for the vast majority of people who need them and who have very different complex needs. Abolition means putting services in the community that are appropriate to the people who are in prison. We know from New South Wales research that the greatest predictor, once a person has left prison, of them ending up in prison again, is the number of times they move house in the first 12 months after their release. If they move house more than two times in their first year after release, they are virtually guaranteed to go back into prison again.
Why do prison activists talk about abolition and not reform?
We talk about abolition because if you are about reforming the system, you're presuming that the system is working in the way that we want it to. We need to always go behind what the crimes are to look at what the person is. And I think people would much rather spend $100,000 a year trying to unravel the reasons why people end up in prison than actually spending $100,000 a year locking people up in prison And that locking people up in prison does not create community safety in the long term. And the obvious example of that is the United States. We all know how very dangerous having a mass incarceration like they do in the States. I think there's over 2 million people inside now. We know that their levels of homicide are much greater than ours. Their levels of violence are much greater than ours. And that it has to be speaking to all of us about the dangers of relying on prison to make a community safety. A community is not made safe by prison. A community is made safe by everybody in the community having a place where they have respect, where they have safety, and where they have meaningful things to do with their time. Now, you know, prison abolitionists aren't saying this is going to happen overnight, because prisons themselves didn't happen overnight. Prisons took a long time to get institutionalised in our society. And what we're saying is that you can chip away at actually a reliance on prison. And the first place to chip away is in providing alternative housing to prison housing. Housing for people who are leaving family violence, housing for children who are wanting to leave families of violence, and housing for people who are leaving prison.
Is it realistic to have a world without prison?
I think it is realistic to have a world without prison, because we need to ask ourselves the questions. Are people born bad or are they made bad? Now, if we aren't people who believe in, you know, biological bad, we have to, as a society, take responsibility for the actions of the people who are part of our society. Now, of course, there are going to be people who have got biological issues that create unsafe situations for the community. But if people get appropriate treatment, for example, mental health treatment, they are perfectly well managed in the community. You know, we talk about, you know, the people who are serial rapists and people who are serial murderers, and you know, of course, they create an unsafe community. But if we have a look at the lives of people who are serial rapists and serial murderers, we can see that their lives in many ways created scripts for them to behave extremely antisocially. And that's what we need to do. We always need to go back to how we treat children within families, how our community treats the most vulnerable in it. How do Aboriginal people feel in our community? Do Aboriginal people in Australia feel valued? Well, you know, I think Aboriginal people in our community don't feel valued. And that's a really good explanation as to why there is so much drug and alcohol abuse in Aboriginal communities. Because for 200 years, they have not felt valued. Their land was taken away from them. They were removed from community. They were removed from culture. They were removed from family. They weren't allowed to speak their language. Those historical crimes reverberate for a long time.
That was Amanda George speaking about the state of prisons in Australia. So how can communities respond to violence without relying on prisons or the intervention of the state? Creative Interventions is a US-based group that provides resources for everyday people to end violence. Its mission is to create community-based options for intervening in violence. I caught up with Rachel Herzing, the Director of Research and Training at Creative Interventions, on a recent visit to Australia. Why is it necessary to develop strategies for ending violence that don't rely on police or prisons?
In my perspective, there are two primary reasons. One is that so far we've seen that the traditional criminal legal responses in the United States not only are ineffective at addressing violence, but also tend to increase or amplify violence where it happens. And if we're talking about domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, we've seen all different kinds of things happen from, you know, increased arrest rates, or the person who makes the call sometimes gets arrested and spends the night in jail, to families being divided by child protective services, to detention and deportation. All of these are kind of the compound effects of the state intervening in these situations. And the second big reason, I think, why we're looking for responses that don't rely on imprisonment and policing is that we really think that communities have a lot of knowledge, creativity, skill, resources at their disposal already within their networks, whether that's a family network or friend network or, you know, a neighborhood network or other kind of community networks. And oftentimes when we rely on police to come in, for instance, and intervene in a situation, all of those networks get kind of cut off or pushed to the side or pressed down, and a very blanket response gets applied to often what are very, very complicated situations.
What are some of the projects that you've developed to help achieve this aim?
Yeah, well, Creative Interventions was started in 2004 by a woman named Mimi Kim, who's a very longtime advocate, domestic violence advocate in the States. And she was finding that she was really limited in terms of the options that she had in providing information or resources to people who either came to see her for help or called hotlines for help. And she kept wondering, well, what can we do instead, and how can we really expand the range of options that people have? So she developed Creative Interventions as kind of a pilot project to test some of that stuff out. The organization has two primary projects. The first is what we call the Community-Based Interventions Project. And that project is a little experiment where people who are facing situations of violence could contact us, and there's a team of people available to help facilitate them through a process that did not involve shelters, cops, child protective services. And they could figure out how to, you know, develop a team of people around them. They could figure out what their own goals were, and then we would help facilitate a process of them reaching their goals. And when possible, to involve also the person who was doing harm in that situation, which is a very different approach than most mainstream approaches in the States. And then the second project is the Storytelling and Organizing Project, or STOP. And that project really tells the stories of what people are trying all day, every day, to intervene in situations of interpersonal violence, and more recently we've expanded to deal with state violence as well. And that's really a collection of anecdotes and stories and lessons about things that people have tried, and some of them are very small and some of them are very elaborate. And the idea with those is that we can really have a bank of resources, a giant toolbox to go and say, oh, this person tried this thing. What if we saw if we could pull a lesson from there and apply it to our situation? But also to kind of give credibility to the kind of everyday actions that people do take to interrupt, prevent, and repair from violence in their own lives.
Can you give some examples of ways in which the STOP project has worked?
Sure. So we spent about the first 2 years really, really working with our partners to train them up on the approaches that we take to collecting and telling stories. And we're very, very careful with that because we treat people's stories very seriously. And we also really honor the process of giving and receiving that kind of information and understand that act as an intervention in or a preventative measure, you know, into violence. So we spent some time training people on using different kinds of recording technology so that they could record stories, and then helping them locate stories in their own communities. Since then, we've transitioned into the current implementation phase and really trying to figure out, okay, now that we have a little core group of story collectors, how can we start really integrating the lessons that we're learning from these stories into the work that people already do? So, for instance, there's a group of people we work with in the southern part of the United States who are developing what they're calling a harm-free zone project. And the logic of that is really kind of on a block-by-block basis to build up the resources and skills necessary so that people don't feel like they need to call the cops when things happen. And they wanted to start working with STOP from the beginning as part of their base building strategy. So if the logic is we already have these stories in our own neighborhood, and we're collecting stories from our own neighborhood, then when you talk to people about, okay, well, what could we do instead of calling the cops, they already have stories right from where they live. So that's one thing that they've done. We work with a group that works with prisoners. They've started to communicate with people in prison about different strategies that they use to help kind of prevent violence and interrupt violence that happens apart from the guards, apart from surveillance, and take those stories outside of prisons and bring them to the outside world. And we've also been working recently on these art-making projects as well. So the idea with that is that we listen to stories. People can start making images that are evoked from the stories that they listen to, with the idea that we'll compile all those, work with some artists and designers to develop campaign posters that would look like, you know, an image, but also like, here's what you could do instead of calling the cops when violence happens. And it's based on things that people have actually tried.
I suppose a lot of us have, you know, been witness to violence or experienced violence and know that, you know, calling the cops is not a very good option. If somebody hasn't been exposed to these kind of ideas before, or they're not part of a community that is, you know, thinks like this philosophically, how would somebody start to try and implement these ideas?
You don't have to be against the cops to be interested in these ideas. You know, I come from a pretty specific political perspective that's not shared by everybody, as you point out, but I also think that really honoring, you know, the knowledge that you already have and the skills that you already have doesn't require you to have a direct confrontational relationship with the police. I think people are doing these things every day. So, for instance, one of the things that happens often when we go out and we talk about the storytelling and organizing project is that people say, oh, well, that's exceptional. I don't have a story like that. I've never tried anything like that. And the more that we talk, we find everybody pretty much has a story. And people are like, oh, is that like the time that, you know? And there are things that are very, very simple sometimes. So one of the examples that I use pretty frequently is the example of, you know, oh, so my dad would go down to the pub routinely, get really, really drunk, and start fights. And the bartender made an agreement to call the house before calling the cops, right? And the other people, the other patrons in the bar would remember, you know, oh, okay, we need to de-escalate this, and so somebody would come and fetch him rather than calling the cops, right? So it prevents people from getting into fights, prevents that level of violence from happening, and it also prevents, you know, anybody from getting arrested, getting fined, spending the night in jail, which can have all of these kind of compound effects that I talked about before. So they can be really simple like that. We've also seen examples of people escorting, you know, people out of parties when things seem a little sketchy or when something's happened. I think that's a pretty frequent thing that most people have experienced and often are like, okay, how can we deal with this in a way that doesn't escalate it but also sets some pretty clear lines? And just recently we've been getting a number of stories like that, which I think are really instructive. We've heard things about, you know, what people do in their families. We've heard some really serious stories about, you know, partner violence. We have one story that we use a lot that involves somebody whose partner is a police officer and is being violent toward them and has a gun and all kinds of things. So it's really a range of stories. But in all of these cases, people really have been able to just call on their friends, their family, their own good common sense. And sometimes they also involve the cops, right? So I think we're interested in the pieces of that that don't involve the state, but oftentimes people also might begin there and find that that's a dead end for them or get to a point where they feel like they don't have other options. So it's not like all of the stories that we collect necessarily are completely free of any mention of police or imprisonment either.
You've been in Australia recently. Can you tell me about some of the work you've been doing here? I know that you were just in Alice Springs recently. You know, how did your work translate to Alice Springs and in particular Indigenous communities up there?
Yeah, we had a great trip to Alice Springs, and I hadn't been there before and felt very, very lucky to be invited to come up. And we met some really remarkable organizers up there and talk to some people who are interested in really addressing racism in the town of Alice Springs. We participated in a community forum up there about community-based responses to racism and racist violence. We talked with people in remote communities, both kind of people living under the intervention and organizers against the intervention, about the strategies that they're using. And for us, that kind of genocidal project is also something that we're really interested in terms of kind of community-based responses to violence. I mean, that's kind of one of the most clear pictures of state violence I've ever seen experienced in my life. And being able to kind of talk to people about what the particularities are of how the intervention impacts their ability to live in the day-to-day. And we talked about everything from, you know, basic card to the prohibitions on alcohol and pornography to kind of the pressure to move in from the homelands to these hubs. We talked about a really wide range of issues with people. And throughout, we were also very, I think, inspired by people's resilience and resistance and fight, and the fact that they don't see the state really as providing them a lot of options, so they've become incredibly creative in thinking about how to respond in different ways, whether that's the walk-offs that we've heard about in some communities and people just walking off the community, or if that's people figuring out ways to deal with basic card, or if that's ways that people, you know, have their own kind of dry-out spots or places that people can go so they can avoid contact with Northern Territory Police and other kind of state agencies. So we learned a whole bunch of things that I think are really, really informative and that we can apply back to the communities that we work with. So one of the things that we did up there was to shoot some video about that organizing work. And we've committed to making a video clip that we'll show to our home communities and that we'll send back for them to be able to use as well. And we brought a message from an indigenous tribe that's not that far from where we live in California to them as a message as well. So we're doing some of that message carrying back and forth, but we've also made a pretty serious commitment to educating our home communities about the fact of the intervention and about, you know, the resistance to it.
That was Rachel Hertzing, Director of Research and Training at Creative Interventions.
Since this program first aired in 2010, Creative Interventions has created a website for their storytelling project and their toolkit. It is www.stopviolenceeveryday.org, and that is all one word, stopviolenceeveryday.org. Sisters Inside also has many valuable documents on their website, sistersinside.com.au.
And that's all for the program today. Women on the Line is Community Radio's National Women's Current Affairs program. It's produced and presented by a range of women broadcasters from 3CR in Melbourne and broadcast nationally on the Community Radio Network. The theme music for Women on the Line is Kerri-Anne Cox's She's Got a Story Too. Today you also heard Born Free by MIA. I'm Marion Prickett, and I hope you can tune in again next time.
To contact Wings, email wings@wings.org. Special thanks to your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps to a Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.